fashion. So that means, of course, can you guess? The metasitta, the discourse on loving kindness. And it's a very powerful discourse. I teach metta practice frequently and chant the metta sutta weekly for years for the online community and the people here at the monastery, but we've never really gone through it in some detail. So I thought we could do that today because it's uplifting and it fills the heart with gladness. And we can look at the key sort of places where the Buddha's speaking about loving kindness and maybe analyze it a little bit in terms of the Buddha's instruction to us, because it starts off with an aspiration, and that aspiration in a sense, or a kind of purpose, and that purpose is to be skilled in our own welfare, atta kusalena, to be skilled in what is good for us. This is one of the prerequisites for metta practice in order to know the path of peace. So the Metta Sutta's aim is actually to attain a peaceful state, which at its highest and deepest level means Nibbana itself. And there's another aim, which is, of course, related, but that aim is to end rebirth. So it goes from, you know, in the very beginning of the Metta Sutta, talking about for one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace, this is how they should practice. And the metta instructions are for that purpose. And then at the end, it talks about the summation of the path, which is that by not holding to false views, the virtuous person, having clarity of vision, dasana sampanno, is not born again into this world. So this means a person has become fully enlightened or extinguished, if you like. Very difficult to find the right words, but it basically means the person is an arhat, the fourth stage of enlightenment, through this practice in and of itself and the resulting wisdom that can arise. And of course, there's an interim period there because the path, like all aspects of the path in Buddhism, is gradual. So it isn't that we go from being kind of bent on our own well-being and, you know, desirous to experience peace to being fully enlightened. There's a practice in between. And that practice starts with the practice of virtue. So the Buddha goes into quite some detail about virtue. And I want to maybe just look at a few of the words because it will be just too long a class otherwise. Maybe some of the vocabulary that is a bit less familiar. Most of us know that we need to be contented and easily satisfied, not proud or demanding, not a burden. Having few duties, etc. But there were some other really interesting words there too, which are a part of virtue. And so I'll read through the English translation, or one of the many English translations, and perhaps give a few different versions of how we can translate certain words. And then we'll look at it a little bit in terms of, you can also look at it perhaps from this perspective, categorizing it slightly. I mean, of course it overlaps, but we can see that some relates more to sila, some relates more to the practice of samadhi, calming the mind, and then some relates to wisdom as well. And alongside that, there are some practice instructions contained in the sutta itself, so the Buddha's own metta instructions. So sometimes we practice loving kindness meditation together, and you may have been to some of Bhante Sujato's events. You may have been coming to my metta teachings or other metta practices that other teachers do. But here we're learning what the Buddha said about how to practice loving kindness using similes and using, using specific terms. So shall we begin? Does that sound good? Yeah. All right. So the translation I have in my hand is actually from a wonderful little book called The Message of Peace and Universal Friendliness by Bhikkhu Jnana Dasana. And I'm going to change the translation a bit because it is using like masculine language, which is quite annoying. I mean, it's the same if it was just female, like feminine language. Can you say that language is masculine or feminine? I don't think that's the right way to describe it. gender specific, should we say, or gender exclusive language. So I'll try and change it to be gender inclusive and all beings inclusive. So here we go. And the translation they've given for the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is from the Kudaka Pata and the Sutta Nipata in particular. In fact, we looked it up today. So if you want to find it in the Tipitaka, in the suttas, it's Sutta Nipata, section on the serpent, which is the first kind of section, and it's Sutta 1.8. So you can look it up later and you can find Bhantisujato's translation and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, all kinds of different translations, and even find the Pali version as well. So here we go. So one who is skilled in their welfare and wishes to attain the state of peace should act thus. One should be capable or able, upright and very upright, easy to instruct, gentle and not conceited, content and easy to support, with few duties and of simple lifestyle, with calm senses and prudent, courteous and not overly attached to families. One should not commit the slightest wrong for which wise people may rebuke them, and should meditate thus. May all beings be well and safe. May they be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, weak or strong, without exception, long, large, or middle-sized, short, small, or bulky, seen or unseen, those dwelling far or near, those born as well as those yet to be born or to be born, may all beings be happy. May no one deceive another, nor despise anyone anywhere, through anger or ill will. May they not wish each other harm. Just as a mother would protect her only child with her life, even so let one cultivate a boundless heart towards all beings. Let one cultivate a boundless heart of friendliness, metta, for the entire world, above, below, and across, unhindered or unlimited, without hatred and without enmity. Whether one stands, walks, sits, or lies down, as long as one is awake, one should sustain this mindfulness of metta. Metta is a kind of mindfulness. This is called, in the Buddha's teachings, the divine abiding. And not holding to wrong view, being virtuous, endowed with clarity of vision, and discarding desire for sensual pleasures, one will not be born again into a womb. So there we go. Hopefully that gave it a slightly different feeling, because it isn't necessarily translating it in the most poetic way for the purpose of chanting, but it's quite a literal translation that I think is also fairly accessible. So hopefully that gave you a little bit of a different flavor and maybe a few words that you haven't heard before, perhaps. So we can see here that the first part is setting us up, one who wishes to find this peaceful state and has skill, is skilled in what is good for them. In other words, knows what's wholesome and unwholesome, should act in this way. And the very foundation of metta practice here, it's saying, is that virtue, is really beautiful, deep virtue, being capable of practice or able to practice. And straight away with this, I think it's important to point out that nobody is or isn't capable. all human beings are actually capable. It's more the case of, do we have the conditions? And the Buddha's telling us we can create these conditions through the practice of virtue. And it's a skill. It's something we have to work at. It's something we have to dedicate ourselves to. And of course, sometimes we have to have external conditions, which are a little bit beyond our control. So please never think that you have what it takes or you don't have what it takes. We're all capable of practicing. And we have the Buddha's teachings. We're hearing the Buddha's words and he's giving us the instruction here. So in this little book, it also says that could include keeping yourself healthy and fit. It could mean being energetic, not lazy, abandoning unwholesome actions and cultivating wholesome actions. These are all things that make you able and capable of practicing loving kindness. And of course, the health doesn't have to be perfect, right? There are many different ways to practice. Further on in the sutta, the Buddha says, you know, we can practice when sitting, when standing, walking, or lying down. And often it's advised to practice metta before we sleep and when we wake up. So it's a beautiful practice to do when you're resting as well. You know, just it actually helps you rest much more deeply. And that's one of the benefits of metta that the Buddha talked about, that it makes it easy to fall asleep. One has no bad dreams and one wakes up refreshed. And even this extends to the end of your life, that you'll die in an unconfused state if you practice lots of loving kindness, because there are so few hindrances that can come in and disturb the mind. So another thing I should have said in the beginning is that one of the first aims of metta and one of the most obvious benefits is that metta undermines and eventually overcomes ill will. And in the Digha Nikaya, I think it is, I just wrote a little note, Digha Nikaya number 3, it actually says that the escape from ill will is cultivating the freedom of mind through metta. Freedom of mind here means liberation of mind. In other words, metta to the point of deep samadhi. That is the escape from ill will. So the more we can practice metta, the more we undermine these hindrances. And along with ill will, the other hindrances too get undermined. And so bit by bit, we're weakening the roots of greed, hate, and delusion. And that's why it's a powerful wisdom practice too, because we can never see things as they are as long as those hindrances are obscuring reality and distorting the truth. So the part on sila then includes this being capable, being upright and very upright. That also means honest. Being easy to instruct, gentle and not conceited. These are all aspects of virtue and attitudes of mind. And then it also goes on to say contented, easy to support, having few duties. In other words, you're not completely busy so that you don't even have time to remember your own well-being or to think of others. And of simple lifestyle with calm senses, prudent, courteous, and not overly attached to families. So these are subtler aspects of sila, but they're still part of sila as taught in the gradual training by the Buddha. Normally he talks about the precepts, the 5 precepts, not to kill, steal, have sexual misconduct, not to lie and not to take intoxicants. But the next part of the gradual training is normally developing contentment, developing a sense of contentment with little and being free like a bird who travels only with their weight of the wings to burden them. They don't have lots of luggage. They don't have lots of belongings. They basically tread lightly in this world. So, and of course, the calm senses is an extension of that. This is the realm of sense restraint, which we discussed last week in quite a lot of detail, looking at the simile of the 6 animals and the senses being like animals that are kind of pulling in different directions. And it's only when those animals, which are attached to strings, are tied to a post. And the post in this simile that we discussed last week is mindfulness of the body. It's only then that those animals can actually weary themselves and get tired, and then they settle down close to the post. So we have calm senses, and this is another aspect of sila. We know how to protect and guard the mind from being pulled into unwholesome states, again, based on what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think about with the mind. Because we can always think about things in a way that's not very helpful. You know, we were talking here a couple of nights ago about the inner critic. Does anyone have experience with the inner critic? Or does anyone not have experience with the inner critic? I see a hand up. I'm not sure if that's the answer to the first question. Anyone never had an inner critic? Probably. Actually, the correct answer to that is yes, I have never had an inner critic because it doesn't belong to you. That's a trick question there, isn't it? So it's not a thing, but it's a pattern of thinking that we've been cultivating and making habitual and not seeing that is for our harm. We're not seeing that it's actually detrimental to our own well-being, wearying for the mind and not conducive to us feeling at ease and feeling in a position to share our love and to be of benefit to others either. So it's not a condemnation, but it's starting to see what we're doing with our mind. Okay. And starting to notice when we're kind of straying in ways that are not healthy for us and coming back to the present moment, to mindfulness and to, to allowing the senses to calm. So these are the aspects of Sila. And I am going to open up pretty soon for discussion, but I just want to go through one or two of them, which may not be your favorite, but I'm interested in, and perhaps are not always translated this way. The one that I'm interested in is prudent, because I immediately kind of, ooh, prudent. That's not kind of my sort of word. It sounds very tight or sort of morally superior in some way. But I like the way they've translated it in this little book or the way they've described it. And I thought I'd share that with you. It's one translation for the word, which word? For the word Nipako. That's actually the word, the name of one of the monks, one of the really nice monks in Australia, who's a very gentle sort of person, chose that name for his monastic name. So here it says, a person is deemed prudent if they're able to discipline themselves by the use of reason. Consequently, they deal with practical day-to-day matters with good sense. They also display good judgment in deciding between virtuous and vicious actions, or virtuous and unvirtuous, we could say, suitable and unsuitable things, danger and safety, by carefully considering the consequences. So this, I like this because this talks about having a sense of discernment and the importance of discernment, which of course the Buddha was very, very keen on emphasizing. You know, he told us not to accept things blindly and to find out for ourselves whether something is of benefit or harm, and to really, you know that for ourselves, despite what other people might say. You know, if something rings alarm bells, we should heed our own inner red flag and find out for ourselves, not just blindly follow others. And I guess I related to this because I have to do a lot of decision making in my role. And I never thought of that as a sort of prudence. But it makes me happy to think that that kind of clarity around decision making can be really useful in the practice of loving kindness, because we're trying to ensure that our decisions go for the good of as many people as possible. You can never please everybody, but as many people and the community at large. It also says one has a good understanding of how to observe virtue and abstain from vicious actions, to organize, manage, and handle their possessions and affairs, to use suitable residences, resorts, food, climates, speech, etc., and to associate with suitable people. Hence, prudence is a highly needed virtue in order to overcome thoughtlessness and recklessness and thus attain mental peace. So again, all directed towards this peace of mind. Oh, someone's put a little comment around that in the box. I just want to see. Prudent, wise or judicious in practical affairs. There you go. Very interesting. So this is bang on. Wonderful. I love that because it really grounds the Metta Sutta in worldly wisdom, doesn't it? It's not some kind of airy-fairy, may all beings be happy. I don't really recognize that there's suffering. May they just be happy. I can't actually face the fact that, you know, there's misery in the world. May they only just be happy. No, we have to know how that happiness is brought about, and we have to see how our behavior may or may not lead to increasing other beings' possibility for happiness. So, and including ourselves, right? So we're not throwing away our discernment here. Wisdom follows us throughout the practice. So, and after that, we're getting on to the actual practice. So, yeah, the bit about not overly attached to families is interesting because in here it's talking about one's own family, but normally that relates to monastics not getting attached to particular supporters who cook nice food, or getting too intimate with the sort of ups and downs of people's family life to the point that they lose their equanimity and they're not able to offer support. Doesn't mean you can't have an affectionate relationship with people. There was a time in the suttas actually where one of the enlightened monks came under inspection by some other monks who doubted his enlightenment. And they went to the Buddha after his passing away and said, oh, we have doubts about this person. What was their destination? And the Buddha said, why do you have doubts? They said, well, he was very affectionate with certain families. And the Buddha said, this person was fully enlightened. It's not a hindrance in any way that he was affectionate and beloved to these families. So that's really interesting. We can have affection without clinging. We can have love, genuine love, and a sense of connection, actually. I've noticed that with people who I consider highly realized or very wise, that they will still have a certain connection with certain people, not out of favoritism, but just out of karma or something like this. But it's not sticky and it's not attached and it's entirely for that other person's well-being and benefit. There's nothing in it for them. It's a service. It's a sense of duty and a sense of putting their energy where it can bear fruit. Ajahn Brahm once told me it's something like, I mean, he sort of jokes, right? But sometimes I ask him, so why do you support me so much? He said, oh, it's good leverage. I put my energy where there's leverage. In other words, you know, I can do something for others. So if he invests in me, then I can invest in the community, right? Rather than giving a whole load of his energy to somebody who maybe isn't going to really benefit. I mean, for example, where a person comes to a monastery and actually they're having some kind of, I don't know, mental health crisis, it might be better for them to seek mental health services. There's no stigma attached. It's not a failure. It's just that monastics are not mental health professionals. So, you know, we have to know where and how to serve different people and where our limitations are too. So, yeah, I'm aware now that if I keep talking, because there's obviously a lot to say, this could easily become a sort of class rather than a sort of discussion. But I would like to start bringing you in. And you're welcome to raise anything around what's been said already. But I also would perhaps suggest that we get on to the next part, which is the actual practice. Because once we've gone through these foundations that metta depends on and that metta can be strengthened through, the Buddha starts to give some instructions. May all beings be well, safe, and happy. Whether they're weak or strong, long or tall, large, middle-sized, short, bulky or small, seen, unseen, dwelling far, dwelling near, those born or yet to be born. And then he even talks about the simile of the mother. I'm just doing this from memory now. It's the simile of even that as a mother protects with her life her only child, so with a boundless heart we spread that same love and kindness to all beings. And it goes from all beings to the whole world. So here we can see the progression from individuals, different types of individuals, to the mother's love for a child, extending it to all beings, then extending that to the whole world. And then he's talking about the directions above and below, in all directions, free from hostility and ill will. And then he also talks about the different postures and refers to metta as a kind of sati. Evam satim maditeya brahma metam vihara Vihara Midamahu, something like this. So it basically means that with that mindfulness, the metta is a kind of mindfulness. One dwells in the divine abodes. Okay, so I've got a few things in the chat, but I think, I'll just read through them briefly without giving too much feedback on them, and then we'll open up for some discussion on the actual practice, perhaps, and any other thing that comes to mind. I also have some questions for you in case you don't have anything to offer or nothing comes to mind. You have a lot to offer just by being there and engaging with this. But yeah, some little questions too, such as what is metta to you? How do you practice? What are the difficulties you face? Could be anything along those lines. So I'll just read out a couple of the questions in the chat. As a Buddhist with Christian parents and relatives, I seek spiritual guidance from spiritual friends to cultivate skillful means in bridging our traditions. Jesus teaches that the greatest commandments are to love God and love one's neighbor as oneself. For a metta meditator, this feels like a joyful invitation to cultivate boundless loving kindness for all. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha uses the term Brahma Metam Viharam, describing the practice of dwelling in loving kindness. Could we explore how the teachings align and how the practice of metta might resonate with the Christian understanding of love? That's a big question, which I'm not sure is entirely on track with looking into the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. It's interesting. God is love, and whoever abides in love abides in God. God abides in him. Could we explain how it might be understood as a form of divine dwelling, whether this parallels the biblical idea of abiding in love? So one thing I'd say, just briefly, because I think I want to stay on track with the Buddhist understanding, is that we don't have the notion of a God. If we're saying God is love, then we could say, well, then God must mean metta, right, or something like this. God means truth. You know, maybe that's what they mean by God. Maybe there is no person in the clouds that, you know, that we call a God, but maybe God is just a description of, you know, a kind of elevated mental state. And I mean, to some extent, that's true in Buddhism too. They call it the Brahma Viharas, which means like the godly realm. So it is a different sort of loka. It's a different world. It's out of the human realm into the sort of godlike realm. But even for that, we don't depend on a god to reach that state. We depend on our virtue. And I think that is the main difference as far as my mind understands it. So I would say that the Buddha is giving you a lot more autonomy and a lot more empowerment, in a sense, to cultivate these things rather than depending on a divine being that we need to worship and devote ourselves to. However, that can make it harder for Buddhists sometimes if they don't have an object of devotion. And I do find it incredibly helpful in my life to have a teacher who I can experience a lot of metta around, and also a very, very wholesome sense of unconditional love in both directions. That is very helpful. But again, I try to depersonalize that and just say, well, it's the qualities of the Dhamma that I'm seeing. It's not that person. That might be a catalyst, but it's the qualities that I see in him that I revere in my heart. So we're trying to come out of dependency on external agents in Buddhism. I think that's one of the main differences, if that makes sense. I hope that answers the question a little bit. It's, again, a big question, so. Please do raise your hands if you want to speak, because so far I only hear my voice, and in the meantime I'll read through the next little message. Hi, it's nice to wake up and have the first thought pop into your head. It's wonderful to be still a human being and wonderful to be able to offer help to others and oneself each day. May we all be well. Yeah, that's a great thought to start the day with, isn't it? Wonderful. Matisha writes, kindfulness. Yes, I think that's related to the idea of metta as a kind of sati, as a kind of mindfulness. Ajahn Brahm called it kindfulness. And to be fair, all mindfulness should include kindness, because kindness is right intention. It's there under right intention, the second factor of the path. So it's the way we're aware should be infused with kindness and with gentleness and with a sense of non-ownership, letting go, giving, benevolence. Okay, it's a lot of, it's because I've been talking a lot, everyone's writing in the chat. okay, one more from the chat and then I'll come to Johnny. And maybe people in this room, if you want to share anything, please feel free. Hang on, the chat just disappeared. I was listening to an Ajahn Brahmali Sutta class and he was talking about the Buddha from before enlightenment and how the Buddha would place thoughts in categories. This made me think that maybe that's a way to move from the inner critic to observer. Absolutely. This is a really great sutta that I actually spoke about with the person who mentioned the inner critic to me. And it's the Majjhima Nikaya number 19, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta. And the Buddha said that while he was still practicing, he was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, which is a point that Ajahn Brahm likes to make. He wasn't enlightened at that point. And a bodhisattva meant somebody still seeking enlightenment. He actually had thoughts of ill will, cruelty, and sensuality, believe it or not. He was human, just like us, right? This is before enlightenment. Even though he had deep meditation, he had lots of experience, he still had these persistent thoughts. And he realized, okay, these are unwholesome. And on the other hand, we have the wholesome. We have sometimes thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of non-cruelty, in other words, compassion, thoughts of letting go, thoughts of renunciation. So these lead to enlightenment and the other thoughts lead away from enlightenment. And then he realized that if he replaces a thought of ill will with a thought of loving kindness, that thought of ill will cannot coexist. Basically, you're either thinking a thought of ill will or a thought of loving kindness. You can't think both at once. So that was his first method of substitution. And it's one of the reasons why metta practice is incredibly powerful for purifying the thinking process. We're actually replacing unskillful ways of thinking with skillful ways. And over time, that creates new and very strong and very beneficial habits in the mind that start to come up more and more readily, more and more spontaneously, even when we're struggling in some way. We might have a moment where we say, oh, this is painful. May I be free. May I be happy. May I be kind to myself. May I be at ease. You know, or you feel a bit scared, a bit anxious. May I be safe. So you can actually start to use it in relation to your mental states and thoughts. It's not just sit down and repeat something like a robot. You're actually using that prudence, right? That discernment about what to pick up when. So I'm coming to Johnny. I hope that makes sense.
I think.
Hi.
Oh, so my question is about the difficulties in cultivating metta in relation to abstraction, so abstract things. And by that, I mean, can you hear me okay?
Just about. I think it's cracking in and out a little bit. If you...
Okay.
I don't know. Well, it's okay. It's okay. If I focus, I can hear you fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any better?
Possibly, yes.
Okay. So for me, I find it easiest to generate that feeling when it's someone who I know, like a real person who I've met, particularly someone who maybe I've met recently. So it's kind of fresh. I can get a sense of them. There's not too much having to construct a clear image. So do you have any suggestions on, I mean, a lot of the sutta seems to include beings that perhaps I won't have a lot of specific contact with, like the unseen or those far away or those to be born. Do you have any suggestions for making it more kind of juicy for those
things? Sure. The way to make the abstract things juicy is to go for what really works for you first. So keep working with the loved people, the people you've just seen, make it real in your mind, make it fresh. The people are not the purpose of the metta. So the purpose of the metta is not to send metta to these individuals. The purpose is to, in a way, I don't like the word use, how can we say? To choose an object of metta that actually enables you to develop loving kindness in your heart. So it doesn't matter who it is. It's not about the impact on those people. It's not about whether they feel it or not. It's to overcome ill will in you, is to cultivate your mind. So we start where it's easy. And if you find the metta arises easily that way, and it protects your mind from ill will, and it kind of nips any potential resentment in the bud, because that can happen. And the Buddha did explain that sometimes we feel resentment arising, and we should start with that person and send them metta before it sets in, basically. So it's actually really good to just start where it's easy. And then over time, you can include more people once the metta starts kind of, it's like a little warm fire in your heart. So it's like once the little fire is kind of going in the what do you call it, where you light the fire, in the hearth, the fire's starting to kind of go, then you put on a bigger stick, which is a harder person, like a person that's kind of neutral, that doesn't mean so much to you, or maybe not necessarily someone you don't know at all, but someone that you don't see very much or you don't think about very much. And then when that's takes the flame and starts burning with metta, then you can put in even a difficult person, and the metta will be so strong that it can continue. So I think in this kind of metta sutta, I'm not sure if it's supposed to be a literal instruction. It's more sort of sketching out the scope of it. So it's talking about all the different possible beings that are there for the sake of inclusivity. Because I think another aspect of love and kindness is that it is inclusive and it is impartial, and it's all beings wherever they're found. So it's just talking about all kinds of beings so that it brings more love to the heart. But you don't have to spend time literally directing it to beings who are not yet born. It would be far too vague, far too kind of intangible to do. But it's just to realize there are beings all around us who breathe and who want birth and who want to be well. And we start from where we are. And eventually, there's so much metta that it can just move in all directions, and it goes beyond individuals. It just goes out to the whole world. And this is the point where we can start to really settle deeply into the metta itself and get quite absorbed. Yeah. So just carry on with where it works. As long as it's working for you and you're feeling that ill will is being gradually softened and reduced, then you're doing a really good job. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll just come to one in the box. I've heard different guidance around sharing metta for those we love who have died. Any thoughts on it? Yeah, so there was something Bhante said, actually, that was interesting. He said that the main reason they don't teach it during the metta session, like during formal meditation, is that when you're with your loved ones, you don't want them to die, you want them to stay. But once they've gone, you really don't want them to come and haunt you. So you don't want them back at that time while you're meditating. But outside of formal metta, you can absolutely share merits and share metta with those who've died. It's absolutely fine. But maybe just not in a sort of meditation sitting, because it might get a little bit sad and it'll be just too close to grief and other kind of interferences that can come up. Yeah. So now I'm coming to people with their hands up, and then I'll come back to the chat. So Benjamin's next, I think.
Hello.
Hi.
I thought of a special Valentine's Day themed question.
Uh-huh.
It's often mentioned that when doing metta meditation, you shouldn't take as the object a person you have romantic feelings towards, yeah, or attraction towards. But they're still people, so theoretically you should still cultivate metta towards them.
Yeah.
You do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that the question? Yeah. 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 So again, it's the difference between the formal metta session and the general cultivation of metta, which includes all beings, because we have to practice metta to all beings eventually, or at least have metta to all beings. The actual metta practice tends to just take people who are easy to work with and who there's very little danger of developing ill will towards, developing lust towards, developing grief towards, etc. So it doesn't have to be the person you love the most. Again, although metta will have benefits for your relationships, it will bring the people you love closer to you, it is not the aim. if that becomes the aim, then it's not unconditional love. We're doing it with an expectation of something in return. So the aim of metta is to start cultivating and developing metta in ourselves. And we take a person who is easy to work with, the kind of person you think of, and you just get feeling of a simple childlike kind of happiness. And there's no issues with this person. It's very easy. It's very natural. You just smile when you think of them. It doesn't even have to be someone super close. I once took as my object of meditation for a whole 2 weeks someone that I'd only known about a year, but she was the person that sponsored my retreat, the Metta retreat. And she, you know, paid my ticket and sent me there. And it was so easy to send Metta because there was such a genuinely grateful and happy feeling in my heart. And then from time to time, I choose my teacher, my first preceptor, Sayadaw Upanyajotha, who was an extraordinary monk, to give it a bit of a charge, a superpower kind of feeling. But I also knew that if I did it with him too much, it was almost too much because there was so much devotion and it would get a bit too Sayadaw-centric. So then I would go back to this other person, and I stayed with the love person the whole retreat. The teacher's instruction was just see how far you can go with that. So later we spread out to other people. So what we're trying to do now is just get a sense of what metta is, the benevolence, the friendliness, the genuine well-wishing, which is part of romantic love, but there are other elements in romantic love that are much more attached, much more partial, much more expectation-oriented. And that's why people divorce or people split up, right? Because we didn't get what we expected. We didn't get our emotional needs met or whatever. We still have metta, but for now, just try and work with people who there's a more simple relationship with. Yeah. Shalina had her hand up. I don't know if you still wanted to speak. No, you're okay. All right. So I'll come to Boyana and then I'll come back to the chat.
Hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that metta was my very first Buddhist practice. I think it's probably partly what led for me to call myself a Buddhist and keeping precepts. So when I first started practicing, I would always begin by imagining a wounded puppy that needed help. This was actually an Ajahn Brahm piece about a kitten that related more to a puppy. And I found that whenever I spent enough time on the puppy and really managed to awaken the metta, then it was really easy to bring that onto more difficult objects, people that I had difficult relationships with.
Yeah.
That even led to calling my rescue dog Metta.
Oh, that's sweet.
Because I almost experienced that exact thing which I had practiced so many times in my meditation when I rescued her. So yeah, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's Ajahn Brahm's way to get things going with the kitten. I mean, it's interesting because officially that's actually karuna, that's actually compassion practice when you think of bringing a being out of suffering and the focus is on their freedom from suffering. But again, the two are so close because metta is just, it's a little bit more universal because it's to all beings, whether they're suffering or not, whereas compassion is specific towards people who are suffering, generally speaking, but it also contains metta. It's like the way love responds to suffering. So yeah, it probably would help with a difficult person. I mean, one other question in the chat here actually is, should we visualize a difficult person as a baby? And that's quite interesting because it can really help to generate metta for people who are more tricky to develop metta for you, not for everyone, right? Not everyone is everyone's difficult person. The difficult person is someone's loved person. So yeah, imagining them as vulnerable, as fragile, maybe as sick, can help you realize they're a human being They want happiness. They don't like sickness. They struggle sometimes, even if they can't show that they do. They certainly do, you know. They were a baby. You don't know what happened to them when they were a baby. We really don't know. So how can we judge? So we can use sort of creative methods to practice loving kindness. But the most important thing, again, if you're doing metta as a formal practice, is to do it a little bit systematically. So we're not just thinking, right, today I'm going to do this difficult person. Let me just start with them and think about them as a baby. Start with either yourself or a loved person. Start with something easy and build it up. And then maybe just introduce a difficult person for a short time. You might actually find that you only need to think thoughts such as, may you be happy, and it might be enough, and you don't need to visualize the person as a baby, etc. But if that just starts happening naturally, fine. But remember, we're trying to simplify, we're trying to pacify the mind, and the deeper we can take the metta, the simpler the object, the more likely we can get into deeper states of meditation through the metta practice itself. And that means we're really starting to uproot aversion from the heart. And once it's uprooted, the object doesn't matter much. If there isn't so much ill will, you just won't have so many difficulties. And the person you didn't like might actually appear to you as a friend. People change categories. It's actually all in our mind. That's the amazing thing about metta practice. You really do realize that we're just training perception. Perception gets fixed in looking a certain way, but perception is malleable. We can change the way we regard and view other beings. And you start to see there is no real reality. It's not that there's a friend and an enemy. There are just beings who suffer and beings that need to be loved. So, Diana.
Thanks, Anurata. Hi. You mentioned the word devotion earlier, and I'm not sure if this is an appropriate question for this discussion, but recently I've been thinking about how my experience of Buddhism doesn't have a lot of devotion involved in it, like some other traditions might. Although I felt a lot of devotion to my first Vipassana teacher, Goenkaji.
Yeah.
And I think I really got a lot out of that experience of feeling that devotion.
Yeah.
Which I no longer really do since he's not with us and various reasons.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? Like, is there a place for devotion in this practice?
I would say absolutely. I mean, the amount of emphasis the Buddha gives to spiritual friendship and, you know, thoughts of respect, thoughts of reverence, thoughts of loving kindness, affection, mutual respect. It's in there in the suttas. And the thing is, it doesn't have to be a teacher. It doesn't have to be the wisest person or the person that you feel the most gratitude towards. I think we can develop that towards one of our companions. There's always something we can revere in another person. There's always some quality. And I make this a daily practice. I don't even try these days. I'm just surrounded by good people and I just see all their qualities. And I don't know, I just feel so much spontaneous loving kindness that it's obvious to me that these people are like on the path. Somebody once, it was actually a Vipassana teacher in India, a woman, and I forget her name. I know her name. It'll come to me. Yeah, because I loved her. And she said to me, when you're serving the retreat, you know, remember that each person is a potential stream winner. They could be a stream winner at any time. They're on the path, right? And it was so beautiful. Pushpa Ben was her name, but not Pushpa Ben Savada, but another one. And she was wonderful. And just that perception, you know, when you see people meditating or you see people listening to the Dhamma, these could be future stream winners. Like, they have all that potential inside them. We really don't know where people are on the path. We really don't know. So I think we can do that. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about monastic life, that we have these wonderful spiritual companions and we are trained to look at one another with kindly eyes. The other thing I would say, I mean, of course, if we can have that devotion to the Buddha, it's fantastic. For me, that's really helpful to develop through coming closer to the Buddha through the suttas, but also through my teachers that seem to have internalized those teachings really deeply. You know some people like this. So you can think of them, forget their faults, forget their things that irritate you or things that you know. I mean, Ajahn Brahm, I know him very well, right? So I know his stubbornness. Okay, I've told him that, so it's fine for me to say it. He knows. We're all stubborn. We're monastics. We have to be stubborn. So, but you know, that doesn't matter. You see the depth of a person's character, the depth of their sila, their compassion, etc. Lastly, of course, the Buddha, but also Goenkaji. You can still remember him. You can still bring it up as a memory. But it takes a bit of work, it takes a bit of effort, but it's well worth it, you know, even if you do that for 10 minutes at the beginning of a sit. It might not seem to bring much immediate moisture to the heart, but if you keep trying, you keep remembering him, his voice, his chanting, his benevolence in sharing the Dhamma without charge, you know, you've been around him, right? I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, you were 10 years my predecessor in the Pali year, so you were like a real old student. So yeah, so you know what it's like. So just talk about it, think about it, have conversations, bring it up, and it gladdens the mind. Yeah, there's also the lovely meditations Ajahn Brahm does on Buddha Anusati, when he gets you to imagine you're a Buddha. This is really nice because it's a kind of another type of reflecting on the Buddha, but without having to kind of feel that you know the Buddha. It's like just imagine his peace, imagine his contentment, his wisdom. Imagine that's there in you. That's also a very beautiful meditation. Okay, hope that helps. I mean, there's so much you could say about these things. It could have a whole hour on that. Coming into the chat, could you say something about the benefits of forgiveness in the context of metta practice? Yeah, so I actually had that written down, three qualities: loving kindness, forgiveness, and patience, which I think go together. And we listened to a lovely talk by Ajahn Brahm yesterday on metta, and he was saying that metta is the nutriment for patience, something like that. If a mother has love for her child, she becomes infinitely patient with that child. And we're talking about a loving mother here, not a traumatized mother who sometimes is unpredictable or, you know, but a mother-like love is incredibly patient because there's so much unconditionality, so much understanding that they're able to, just sustain that loving kindness. And I think forgiveness is very similar. If you have a lot of loving kindness, you're more able to forgive, because part of the nourishment for loving kindness is also seeing the goodness in another. Seeing the beauty in another can give rise to loving kindness. It's easier to forgive their faults because you're not focusing on them all the time. But of course, resentment is a blockage to metta. So forgiving, overcoming resentment will give rise to more metta. So yeah, forgiveness is a beautiful ideal. I think that it's the process, like everything else in the path. And it's important not to push ourselves into forgiving before we've addressed our feelings. Rather than doing the practice of may I forgive you, or I forgive you for whatever you've done by body, speech, or mind that's intentional or unintentional, I offer forgiveness. I often, you know, at the end of a retreat or something, if we do that, I often say, I have the intention to forgive. I truly wish to forgive. I'm going to work on forgiving. I have the intention to forgive in my own time. And I trust that I will be able to forgive in time. So this is really helpful, I think, rather than pushing ourselves. Of course, we can, you know, do some reflection about the benefits of forgiveness and the danger of ill will. But it's just a bit of a tricky area because we shouldn't beat ourselves up if that's not immediately forthcoming. Metta practice is going to help with forgiveness because it overcomes resentment. So the two definitely go together. And, you know, metta softens the heart. So we're able to see that, okay, a person's not perfect, but we're not perfect either, but we can still wish them well. You don't have to love them. You don't have to feel bliss whenever they come to mind, but we can still wish them well. And sometimes people behave badly because they're hurting, because they don't know any better. They're stuck in their habits, you know, they're not even well. And the Buddha said another way to overcome resentment, which is, you know, the other side of, it's something we have to forgive, is to have compassion and to regard that person as a sick person, a person who's lost in the desert without food, without water, without any attendant, without someone to look after them. Maybe they don't even know the Dhamma, or they've lost the clarity around the Dhamma and how to practice. So they're like a sick person. So when we see them that way, it becomes easier to forgive. So there are a few thoughts, but it's a process. The beautiful thing about the Dhamma is that whenever we develop one quality, all the other qualities seem to strengthen too, if it's really genuine. If you have more patience, you tend to have more metta. If you have more faith, you have more patience. I found that's a really interesting link as well. Confidence in the teachings, confidence in the process gives you patience. So you can bear with the process of forgiveness. You can give it time. Because you trust that if you plant the right seeds, the results will come. I hope that is something that can be of help. Yeah. Metta is the basis of sila, dana, and kalyanamitta. I mean, we can see this in every direction. It's just so amazing. I love it when we start to see the Dhamma like this, you know, that it's like this cake with all these ingredients. They're all mixed together, and you take the cake, you get the metta, you get the patience, you get the virtue, the whole lot. I would completely agree. I mean, in the Eightfold Noble Path, it starts with right view. It's an appreciation of suffering and how beings suffer and how it all suffering is universal. We're all in it together. Okay. It's not, I suffer. I'm alone suffering. We all suffer together. We all, you know, whether we can see it at one point or not, we're going to go through it. If not now, when we die, right? When we lose our loved ones, when we can't do what we want because we're unhealthy. And yeah, as an outcome of right view, it only makes sense to have thoughts or intentions of loving kindness towards beings who suffer, thoughts of non-cruelty towards beings who suffer. And the next factor of the path, surprise, surprise, virtuous action. If you have intentions of loving kindness, you're not going to hit a person. You're not going to steal from a person. You're not going to abuse a person. If you have thoughts and intentions of loving kindness, you're going to use right speech. You're going to give to a person. You're going to be generous, etc. Right? So yeah, it is the basis of sila. Loving kindness can take you all the way. I'm quite convinced of that. I think it's a vehicle in and of itself because it brings all the other qualities along with it, and it has the benefit of being very pleasurable and helping you live harmoniously with others, having a lot of friends, and being able to benefit many. So it's a beautiful, beautiful practice. Shalina.
Hello. Yes. Just in response to what you were saying about thoughts of non-cruelty, that made me think about Sangha Sankappa, and the sort of the three parts of that, the renunciation, the non-violence, non-cruelty. So extending that to metta, that means really that metta is part of panya, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Well done with the connection. Absolutely. Because the first two factors of the path, right view and samasankappa, right intention or right thought or right motivation, Ajahn Brahm likes to call it, where you're coming from rather than where you're going to, is actually in the aspect of wisdom. So the Eightfold Noble Path, the first two are the wisdom khanda. You can call it a khanda, the component. And then the next ones are the virtue. And then the last three, the right endeavor or effort, the right sati, mindfulness, and the right samadhi, they are the samadhi factors of the path. So yes, correct. Intentions and motivations of loving kindness, avyapada is a synonym. It's literally non-ill will, is part of wisdom. Yeah, because it's wise to be kind. It's really stupid to be unkind. It's really detrimental to our well-being and to others' well-being. And it never solves the problems in the world. You know, even if we see people who are, you know, really cruel or really harming others. You know, if we then start resonating with the same sorts of thoughts of, oh, this person, they're so terrible, I wish they'd be harmed, you know, sometimes we can think this, right? That is making us just like them, and it's never going to solve the problem. We're literally getting infected by their cruelty. So I think in times where we can see a lot of this happening on the global kind of, it's not a stage or a platform, it's real life. We need to make an even stronger resolve not to veer into that way of thinking and to actually cultivate metta more and cultivate forgiveness more. But metta doesn't have to be passive. It can be active as well. Yeah. And it will make you more resilient, you know, when beings are being harmed. It will give you more clarity about the action to take. But we can't let ourselves slip into that. That's the biggest danger, actually, through associating overmuch with the bad things happening in the world. Protect your mind. Why is it so much harder to hear the parents talking bad about other people and often have the focus on bad situations than hearing other people complain a lot? Hearing others complain a lot. Why is it so much harder to hear parents saying bad things about other people than hearing other people say bad things? Is that the question? Yeah. Yeah. It's true, isn't it? Maybe it's because they're our first caregivers. And so we look up to them as examples. And when we hear them doing that, it hurts, you know. For me, I mean, I actually, it's hard to say these things in case they listen. But sometimes, look, human beings are human beings, okay. So sometimes you had the feeling that at the dinner table things were being said about colleagues or maybe about me as a teenager when I was out of the room. Oh, I felt so bad. I felt like so paranoid. And oh, it was just kind of heartbreaking, honestly, to think that, you know, things might be being said that weren't very nice. Because it made me feel unsafe, I think. I felt unsafe. And I suppose, yeah, you want to think your parents are perfect somehow when you're young. You want to see an example. And I mean, my parents were great, okay? So it's not that anyone is 100% perfect, unless you've got arahat parents, in which case they wouldn't have sex and you wouldn't be born. So, so you know, that's impossible, isn't it? So, yeah, it's harder. And I guess, again, not to judge, but to understand they're probably facing challenges that I'm not going to face. I made a decision not to be a parent. I don't want that kind of dukkha. Thank you very much. I think if I now did have kids, I'd probably understand that my parents were amazing and that they really probably had quite a hard time being parents, having not been to parent training school or anything like that. Right? There are no such things. So, yeah, it is harder. But it's also because parents are mine. Huh? Things and people who we think of as me and mine are going to be, we're going to be a lot more attached to the way they behave. You know, if they're my parents, they should behave like I think parents should behave, right? Because they're mine. It doesn't matter if somebody else's parents behave differently because they're not my parents. But if my parents behave like that, that sort of hurts my own self-view, doesn't it? So I think that's always harder when it's people we're close to. It's the attachment side of metta. We can't see them objectively because of the attachment, which is an impurity of metta. They call it the far enemy. No, the near enemy in the Visuddhimagga, the commentaries. They call it the near enemy. The far enemy is like it's the far enemy. The near enemy, the obvious enemy, is the ill will. And actually fear as well is the opposite of metta. So that's important because often when you see conflict in the world and especially discrimination, marginalization, rejection, you know, keep the refugees away, it's because we've othered them. We see them as other. We've dehumanized them and we don't understand that all beings are just like us. So self-view is really a big obstacle, and which is why this metta-sutta ends by not holding to false views. The pure-hearted one, the virtuous one, has clarity of vision and is not born again. So this is talking about sakkaya-ditti being overcome. Sakkaya-ditti means personality belief or self-view. So when it says not holding to false views, and it is false, I think in some of the translation they've translated it as fixed views, but it is actually meant to be false or wrong view, because wrong view prevents the flow of loving kindness. When we believe in self, we believe in me, we believe in mine, my people, my country, my possessions. These people are different from my people. And this is one of the root causes of, I think, of all wars and all conflicts. Okay, I'm going to comment on one more thing before we end. A couple of more things in the chat. Metta powerfully burns off bad karma. Yeah, burns off. I don't know. I don't know if the Buddha uses that word. It's a sort of, definitely the Jains like to think of it that way. It certainly dilutes it, let's say. And it also, in a sense, transcends it. So there's the simile of the salt crystal in the lake, as opposed to in the glass of water. You put a salt crystal in a glass of water, that means a small mind that's not developed, that's not wide and expansive and free. It's not gone to greatness. The water tastes very salty. You put the same salt crystal in a lake, in other words, in a mind of loving kindness, gone to greatness is one of the similes for one of the descriptions of a mind that's in jhana, in deep samadhi with metta or any other practice, then you hardly taste the salt. So in that sense, the bad karma is barely perceptible. It barely comes up at all. It's like you've got a force field around you. And even if it comes up, it has little impact. Yeah. So metta is primarily for overcoming one's own ill will. Have I understood that correctly? And it's not primarily about doing something wholesome for others, is it? Well, the two are completely connected, because if you've overcome your own ill will, you will only do wholesome things. You will only act from a place of metta. So I think rather than either or, it's more about addressing the root. So the root of doing unwholesome things is actually greed, hatred, and delusion. So by addressing our own ill will, we're kind of going to the cause of all unwholesome action. And like we were saying, metta includes discernment. It includes qualities that lead towards deepening wisdom. So we become much clearer about what's wholesome and what's unwholesome. So yeah, it's both. And I suppose it's a really good question, because it also means that we can act at both levels. We don't have to only sit on the cushion and develop metta and try to uproot ill will from the heart, the depth. We can also overcome it simply by doing good, because we're cultivating really strong behaviors, and that will start to affect the way we think and the way our mind works. So we can come from both sides. And in here, there's a lot of talk about things we can do externally, like being easy to support, being contented, not proud and demanding. These are all wholesome acts. But yeah, we can also act with loving kindness. I often think actually that it's not real love if it's just a thought. Real love needs to manifest in action. And I never do this. I never quote other religions particularly, but there is a beautiful, I think it's Khalil Gibran, is he a Sufi mystic? Anyway, he's from the Middle East somewhere. I think he was just a philosopher. I'm not sure he was a mystic, but he was obviously very wise. And he said something like, work is love made visible. I just love that. Work is love made visible. Like if we can actually make work about, and a way to express our love, then we're never going to complain about how much work we have to do. It's like you are making your love, your intention, your goodwill visibly, not visible to show it off, but have effects for other people. You're actually loving people actively. And to me, just saying the words, you know, I love you, it doesn't really mean that much. So let's celebrate Valentine's Day by doing good things for one another and keeping our minds as wholesome as we can, and just perhaps ending today by maybe resolving to just bring a little bit more metta into our lives and into our practice, and filling in those moments that you have when you're waiting in line or you're kind of trying to get sleep or you're sitting around getting a little bit irritated, just going back to, may I be happy, may all beings be happy, may I be safe, may all beings be safe. May I be peaceful. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be free from harm. Isn't it beautiful just to say that and just to hear that? I feel like it means a lot. So I'm going to end there. Sorry if I haven't come to your chat, but I would like Manoj to say a few words for the last 2 minutes, if you can hang on two more minutes, and then I'll mention tomorrow's event.
Oh, thank you very much, Venerable, and it is such a fitting sutta day for this today, Valentine's Day. Why not talk about metta? So I'm going to talk not about metta, but about generosity today, about giving. It is also a practice that invites us to reflect honesty in our personal situation and means. And when we consider giving to another and to work, as Venerable mentioned now, to family or spiritual life, we may meet an edge of discomfort that poses a question: what contribution could we make that would both respect our financial situation and also allow for the possibility of extending ourselves in services to the others? And what would it be like to give for the benefit of all, yet to expect nothing in return, as the Metta Sutta says? So here's the opportunity from Anukampa. We offer several ways you can cultivate this beautiful quality of giving. You see in the Anukampa website, we've got a link to donate. There is an opportunity for a one-time donation in any payment, either by bank transfer or through a PayPal. And then you can offer a standing order, or you can have a drop-in or online, or you can do volunteers. So there's so many different ways. And you can provide meals, but I think that calendar is getting pretty filled up. You can do a cooked meal, or you can deliver it. You can send in groceries, then there is a needed item list. So there's so many different ways. Have a look at the website. Then there is other events. So we keep on updating the events. And Venerable Chanda will talk about tomorrow's event as well in a bit. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Manoj. And thank you for your generosity, all the co-hosts and everybody here, for being together. And you said it was about generosity and not metta, which is the emphasis. But even generosity is an act of metta. So it's all connected. It's wonderful. So thank you for all your support, everybody here. We feel incredibly supported, to the point that I know that now I am in a position, the community is in a position to train other nuns. So this is going to start happening sooner than later. Can't say exactly when, but I feel very confident. So I just want you to know that this is not feeding me. This is feeding the Sangha, and this is feeding the Dhamma and the spread of the Dhamma. So it's never really about an individual, and it's always about community, which is something I think we're sorely in need of these days. So as a part of our service to you and to the community, we have other events coming up. Tomorrow there's no metta meditation because we have a two-hour event with Ajahn Brahm to talk about ways to be involved also, and to have some Dhamma discussion, some opportunity for questions, and some fun little auction as well. Just for fun. It's kind of sweet. And we have signed books, and we have some paintings, and I don't know, some little bits and bobs. And then what else is coming up? I guess next week there's a sutta class and a metta meditation. So that's the following week. And then there'll be some day retreats with me. And there's also a couple of retreats here at the monastery, just little half-day retreats. So one on the 15th of March, one on the 19th of April. It's all online. Plus, we just put our newsletter out, which probably most of you know, and it has all Ajahn Brahm's June events. So we have an online retreat with him for 6 days, I think it is, full days, and a two-day weekend retreat and some other public talks. So a lot of that will be in and around Oxford. So I really hope that you can join. We already have quite a few people booked in, actually. We've got a big capacity, but we do have like sort of 30 or 40 people already booked online. So if you're thinking, yeah, I'll do it in a few months, do it now. You'll probably still get in, to be fair, on the online retreat, because people tend to drop out a little bit. But yeah, I just hope to see you somewhere in person soon. So take care, everybody, and I'll leave you there.